This audio file is number 2 of 3 available at www.shun.net/inclination. The recording that follows is excerpted from episode number 44 of William Shun's Shuncast, a podcast freely available at shun.net/podcast, or through the podcast directory of the iTunes Music Store. Inclination, a novella by William Shun. First published in Asimov's Science Fiction, April-May 2006. Part 2. The cleanliness, calm, cool, and quiet of the quarter stand in stark contrast to what I've left behind. It's evening by our clocks. We run here on only one shift. The few machinists out and about look at me strangely as I pass from outside. It should feel good, this homecoming after an eternal shift away, this shedding of weight, this lightness, this cooling of my sweat. But I find myself keyed up and restless before I've even reached the branching to wheel and axle. I know Thomas will be waiting for me, wanting to know how the day went, but I can't confine myself at home just yet. Instead, I lower my head and trudge to gymnasium. The machines are manned mostly by levers, all older than I, but one station opens up before long. I do my best to complete the ritual properly, pitting every muscle group against the pulleys as I rehearse the builder's code in my mind, but I'm barely into the first canto before my sore muscles are quaking. What's more, I can't keep my thoughts focused. My mind keeps reaching back to worry images of naked flesh, sometimes colored naturally, sometimes blue or green. One by one, the levers are finishing up and heading to the cleansing room, some of them whispering and giving me looks as strange as the ones I got outside from the sculpted. I rush to try to complete the minimal requirements before the place fills up with inclined planes, but in vain. I'm not quite done when Nicodemus and another plane named Amos arrive. I see them from across the room, over the tops of three ranks of machines. I duck my head, but too late. Nick spots me and hurries over. The station next to mine is empty, abandoned just moments before. Nick, his face cautiously friendly, slides into the seat, leaving Amos to fidget awkwardly in the aisle before us. "Sela, Jude," Nick says. "Sela," I say, mouth dry. Nick begins some warm-up stretches of his arms and back. "You weren't at Skola today," he says. I look straight ahead, pumping away with my arms in bellows mode, but Amos is right there staring at me, so I focus on my knees instead. "No," I say. "Malachi heard you were outside," Nick says. "Yeah, at the hub," Amos says. "He said you had a job." A wary hope fills Nick's voice, but whether it's hope that the rumors are true or simply hope that I'll talk to him, I can't tell. Either way, I can't look at him. I can't look at his golden hair, his glistening shoulders, his wise blue eyes. But I can't not answer. "That's right," I say gruffly. "I guess you won't see me much in class anymore." "Is it true about the sculpted?" Amos says. He's a skinny kid, and he practically dances from foot to foot. "They drink blood instead of water?" "Amos, I see a free machine over there," Nick says with a jerk of his head. "But..." "I'm nearly done here," I say. "Better hurry, Amos." I can't see Nick's face, but I hear the tone of warning in his voice, and I see the answering expression of querulousness on Amos's face. Amos stalks off, even as I fight down the unwelcome surge of warm emotion in my chest. I rest for a 12 count, saying nothing, then embark on another bellows set. Nick has launched into a set of cherry pickers. "So what's with you, Jude?" he says between reps. "What do you mean?" You've been avoiding me for a couple of weeks now. What did I do? I sigh, clinging to the hand grips and letting my upper body sag. It's not you, Nick. Then what is it? Is it about this job? What am I supposed to tell him? That I've started to worry I like him too much? I can hardly express the thought even to myself. It's not about the stupid job, I say, though I'm aching to tell him about everything I've seen and done today. I cut my set short and stand up, infuriated. Great builder, you're so... Oh, flash can it. I rush to the cleansing room with all the dignity I can muster, which isn't much, aware of all the eyes on me. In the quick glimpse I got of Nick before I fled, there was hurt and concern. He hadn't yet broken a sweat. I try to put him out of my head among the straggling levers in the steam-filled shower. I try to conjure the illusion of camouflage I felt in the showers at the hub, as if I could hide myself amongst my sculpted crewmates and never be seen. Here, I feel anxious and wrong, like I don't belong. But I certainly don't belong there. Scanting my cleansing, I dress quickly and hurry into the main corridor. The crowds here are about as thick as they ever get, but seem downright sparse compared to outside. People stride lightly from their duties back to their branches, men and women, boys and girls, as evening stretches toward the dinner hour. I envy them their apparent lack of care. "Jude! Jude!" hails a gentle voice, and I raise my head. I hadn't realized my neck had bent, as if in stronger gravity. It's Soraya, a pulley my age who's walking the other way. "Oh, Sela," I say. She takes my sleeve and draws me to the side of the corridor. "Missed you at Skola," she says, voice low. Not that we have any of the same classes, but the boys and girls do see each other at lunch. Often I've wished I could learn the simpler skills the girls ply, like producing rough fabrics on machines the men construct. But the one occasion on which I expressed such a desire to my father is one I'm not likely to forget. I was younger then, and hadn't learned better. "I wasn't there," I say tiredly. "I know," she says, a look of eager horror on her face. "You are outside. Helena saw you go this morning. So what was it like?" My eyes are already straying down the corridor toward escape. How can I explain what it was like today? I'm too confused. "It's the Wrecker's workshop out there, truly," I say, pulling away. "Look, I'm sorry, but I need to get home." She lays a cool hand on my arm. She's very pretty with her enviably long yellow hair, and she's nearly as tall as I am. "Jude, what's wrong?" she asks, her face close to mine, eyes filled with concern. "Was it that horrible? You can tell me." I want to weep. I have friends, sure, or I did. But what I've never had is someone I can confide in, someone I can really trust and open up to. That's all I want. "Soraya..." I feel her eyes searching my face, but I can't quite meet her gaze. "What is it?" she says. Am I really going to say it? She's always been nice to me, kind. I glance up quickly. "What do you think about Nick?" "Nicodemus?" A little crease appears between Soraya's fine eyebrows. "He's okay. He's nice. Why?" I shake my head, my stomach turning inside out. "It's just, you know, he's such a great guy." I trail off as her eyes get a little wider. "Oh," she says quietly, almost in wonder. "I mean, he's been my best friend for such an incredibly long time," I say. She nods slowly, focused on some inner vision. No, I see. I get it. So, you know, who would have thought?" The ghost of a pensive smile touches the corner of her mouth. She kisses me suddenly on the cheek. "Thank you, Jude. Thank you. I'll talk to you later." With that, she trails off down the corridor, yellow hair billowing in the quarter G, leaving me to wonder desolately what in space just happened. Thomas is waiting for me at the cabin, reading the manual. He looks pointedly at his chronometer as the hatch closes behind me. "I expected you sooner," he says. "I stopped for devotions on the way back," I say. "I thought I might be too tired later." He nods, accepting this, and I breathe a sigh of relief. "How was it today?" he asks. I shrug. "Fine, I guess." "Did you work hard?" "I think I did." "Crew treat you okay?" I take off my cap and rub my head. I don't want to get into it all with Thomas. They were fine. They didn't pay me much mind. Thomas closes his manual, a finger marking his place. "You be polite around them, Jude, but keep your thoughts to yourself. That's the way to stay true among the sculpted." "I will," I say, though already I feel duplicitous. Thankfully, that seems to close that subject. The only other thing Thomas seems to want to know before he goes back to his reading is when I expect to be paid, something I haven't given much of a thought to. I assumed that was something he would have worked out with Rennie already. I prepare our dinner on the fold-out stovetop, a stew of ground meat, beans, and vegetables. The activity proves more calming and centering to me than devotions did. But that night, as I drift towards sleep, my mind keeps turning back to the women in the locker room and to the wooden chest bolted to the deck not 2 feet from my head. Kaya's chest. The screw is a peculiar machine, partaking directly as it does of aspects of the axle, the inclined plane, and the wedge, and often requiring the application of the lever to fulfill its purpose. This is fitting, given its function as the aspect that both joins together and elevates, and as a representation of the way in which men and women join together in holy communion with the builder to ignite the spark of life. Sacred as it is, I've always been a little embarrassed by the screw, a little wary of it. Maybe if that were my ward, I'd have a better understanding of it, a healthier attitude toward it. But I've never been quite comfortable with its symbolic freight. Love and apotheosis strike me as less the screw's nature than doing violence to whatever surface it encounters. I find it difficult to credit that I will ever come to completely trust and adore the screw. My work schedule is 7 days on and 3 off, one full S week as reckoned by the sculpted. My first weekend falls on a Thursday through Saturday by the guild calendar, which means scola every day while I'm supposed to be taking a break. Neither my long stretches without a day of rest nor my falling behind at scola seems to bother Thomas much, but it bothers me. When I dare bring this up, he tells me the builder is blessing us for our sacrifice, though I don't see what sacrifice it is that he's making. By my second S week on the job, I've begun to feel comfortable and confident in Null G, and competent, if not so comfortable, with my fishbowl's graphic overlay. It's as if I'm looking at a raw and exposed layer of reality that should more properly be covered, or at the very least from which I should avert my eyes. Though, just as in the locker room with my crewmates, doing so is practically not an option. I'm on friendly terms with most of the crew, even if I can't quite bring myself to consider any of them friends. We're too different for that, both in our worldviews and in our expectations of what friendship means. For one thing, they don't seem to have a problem with the occasional tweaking of one another's anatomy in the showers. I do, as they have learned. I've spent most of my lunch hours and several more walks home chatting with Derek. Despite the fact that he's so obviously unlike me, he has a directness, a curiosity, and a willingness to take my arguments seriously that I can't help but like, even if I can't always effectively rebut the points he makes. I consider him a goad to make me apply myself more diligently to my studies. I retain the faith that answers exist to his objections, and if I can't find them and express them articulately, then I'm hardly a worthy ambassador for the guild. It's end of shift on 7 day of my second S week on the job when Rennie calls us together in the break room. "Got some news, little Stevies," she says, executing a sort of four-handed cartwheel up a chair to perch on her favorite table. The animated chatter anticipating our weekend break quiets down. 4 day and 5 day next week, we've got a special assignment coming up for anyone who wants in on it. Berth A11, prospecting ship full of scientific samples. Very delicate, both the ship and the cargo. Berth's going to be fully evacuated, so there's hazard pay. But only those of you rated for vacuum will be eligible. If you don't want in, that's fine. We'll have plenty to do here. But if you want in and you're not vacuum rated, it's not too late to get that way. You can even take shift time to do it without getting docked. I just need to see your certification first thing 3 day if you want in. Understood? All right, that's it. Rennie draws me aside as the others file off to the showers. "This is a good opportunity, kid," she tells me in a low voice. "You're a good worker, and you sure don't want to miss out on triple pay." She's right, I don't. I can imagine how happy Thomas will be to see the extra credits. "How do I get vacuum rated?" I ask, watching two tiny distorted me's in her silvery eye globes. "Is there a test I take or something?" Not really, Rennie says. "What it mostly entails is getting your lungs and eyes and ears vacuum hardened. You'd be wearing a pressure suit in the berth, of course, but if it should fail, you could suffocate before we got you out of there and repressurized. Regs don't let us subject you to that risk." My breath catches. "What you're talking about, that would mean sculpting, wouldn't it?" "Just a small bit, internally." The pay would be welcome, but I have to shake my head. "No offense, but I can't do that. I'm very sorry." Rennie shrugs, an elaborate motion of her hind shoulders. My reflection dances crazily in her eyes. "What can I say, kid? It's your choice, and I sure won't think any worse of you for it. But don't make the decision now. Think about it over the break. Get the details from Jeff. Talk to your old man, see what he says." "Right," I say. "I already know what he'd tell me." "Thomas ain't a bad guy, for a wheelie. Talk to him, kid." All the way to the showers, cringing, I can hear Thomas telling me the wrecker's in me. But I can't quite shake Rennie's insistence that I bring it up with him. That evening, over our humble dinner, I blurt it out before I can reconsider. "Rennie says there's a special job next week. Extra pay. And she's pushing me to do it." Thomas puts down his fork. "And?" he says, glaring at me over the table. "And I'd need some small modifications. Vacuum hardening." Thomas bows his head. Today's a Saturday in the quarter. What would in other circumstances have meant half a day at Scola for me and a morning of light community service for him? But neither of us follows a normal schedule now, and we're each exhausted from the labors of the day. I wait for him to speak, not chewing, heart in my throat. Not that I don't know the right answer. I only have to ask myself what the builder would say. Or my mother, I think. The tip of my non-slipper grazing the wooden chest beneath the fold-out table that spans the width between the bunks. The chest contains Kaya's clothing, which, despite the reg against storage of unnecessary mass, Thomas has never been able to bring himself to recycle. It's almost as if he's waiting for her to come back. I'm not, though. I don't have many firm memories of Kaya. And in fact, Thomas has told me so often that my mother is with the angels now that that's how I nearly always picture her, dressed in spotless white, with huge feathered wings furled above her, looking down on me from on high. I know what she would think if I broached the topic of transfiguration. I know what she does think, in whatever level of the builder's mansion she's watching me from. At last, Thomas forks a bite of boiled potatoes and carrots into his mouth and peers at me, practically through me, from under lowered brows. "You told her no, right?" I flinch a little. It takes a moment for me to realize he's talking about Rennie, not Kaya. "Of course," I say. My words feel defensive, as if he's somehow already forced me to lie to him. Wrecker take that woman, anyway. He shovels more food into his mouth and chews silently for a few bites. When he speaks again, his voice and his eyes, unexpectedly, have softened. Son, I know they teach us at Temple never to compromise with the world, to always live as if we're with the Builder in his mansion. But in practice, that's just impossible. We all make compromises. We have to, or we couldn't get by. We couldn't live. The tricky part, no, the hard part, is knowing what's okay to compromise and what isn't. You have to figure out where that dividing line is, and then stay well back from it. When you try to walk it... Thomas folds his hands together and stares down at the table. Jude, son, I can tell you what happens. You fall. You tell yourself you won't, but you do. He clears his throat, lips compressing almost convulsively. I just want you to be happy. Maybe that's not what this world is for, but Builder knows it's what I want for you. His eyes rove this way and that, never meeting mine, and he clears his throat again. Once upon a time, this would have been where I edged around the table to give him an awkward hug. Tonight, I can't. My soul cries for him, but I'm not a little kid anymore, and I just can't. We finish our meal in silence. The next day is Temple, the first Sunday in 3 guild weeks I've been off work. Thomas and I sit toward the back of the long, low chapel, which sits near the AD gate at the opposite end of the quarter from the PM gate. The bulkheads are of brushed gray metal, with 3 of the 6 machines etched on the left wall, 3 on the right, and the carpenter's square on the wall behind the pulpit. Inclined plane ward meets 3rd every Sunday, in the late morning slot. During Foreman Saul's sermon after the sacrament, I spot Nicodemus several rows ahead and to the right. What caught my eye was his golden head tilting back as he smiled wide at something the person next to him had whispered in his ear. The person next to him has long, shining yellow hair. The person next to him is Sariah. I blink hard for the next several minutes. I shift and fidget through the rest of the sermon. The pew is cold and rigid, dumb, unyielding matter, and no matter how I try, I can't get comfortable. I'm supposed to meet the foreman for my private instruction after church, but when the service ends, I rush back to the cabin instead, with a vague excuse to Thomas about my stomach. 2 full days of Scola still ahead, catching up on subjects where I'm falling further and further behind, before I get to return to work. I don't know how I'm going to make it. Wednesday comes at last, one day to the rest of the station, and in the break room in the early morning, Rennie reminds the gathered crew that we have only 2 days left to sign up and show vacuum certification if we want in on the special gig. She looks my way, but I duck my eyes. Funny, I've spent the past 2 days at Scola avoiding Nick and looking forward to one day, and now that it's here, it looks like I'm going to spend the day avoiding Rennie. I'm such a bent nail, I can't stand myself. Our client today is a Thunder-class starship, Calder Equation, which we laid with supplies bound for the exomorph colony at Van Manen's star. It's hard work, but mostly mindless, and I find my cares evaporating for the first time in days. I feel best at mid-shift when we break for lunch, but the rest of the day is marred by the clock in the corner of my vision, ticking down the minutes until I return to gravity's embrace. At shift's end, after showers, I ask Derek if he'd like to go somewhere for food. He's invited me to eat after work several times now, but I've worried not just that Thomas would find out, but that I wouldn't be able to find anything appetizing in the public cafeterias. Tonight, though, I'm desperate enough to talk that I think I can overcome my food objections. Delighted, Derek leads me all the way to a dim cafeteria 2 levels in from the rim. I'm not sure what I was expecting, but certainly not this gloomy cave with the dark red walls and the low ceiling. Quiet, lilting string music plucked out by unseen hands drifts on the air, which smells gently dank and laden with minerals. Thick pillars and curtains of leafy plant life obscure the view from one end of the place to the other, though here and there I can see tables of two, three, or four, the sometimes asymmetrical faces of the patrons lit from below by flickering orange light. Perhaps it's the dimness, but I no longer find their deformities as hideous as I did at first. A woman in a lumpy black cowled robe leads us through the compact maze of foliage to a table against a black painted bulkhead studded with white pinpricks. It isn't until we take our seats in form-fitting smart matter chairs that I realize the bulkhead isn't a bulkhead at all, but a viewport, a hole punched through 15 centimeters of metal and plugged with glass or something like it. "Wheel and axle," I murmur, stunned. I can't take my eyes from the bright, nail-hard stars. "Netherheim and Freya should come into view before you're finished," the cowled woman says. "That's a sight to behold." She makes an arcane gesture in the air. "Now, let me call your attention to today's specials. Perhaps a hard copy menu would be in order for my friend here," Derek says, nodding toward me. "Oh, certainly," the woman says before receding like smoke into the shadows. The surface of our table glows a dim swirling orange, making Derek's skin look like polished stone and his eyes smolder with fire. "So what do you think?" he asks. "It's not what I expected at all. I pictured something more, well, functional from a cafeteria." "Cafeteria, eh?" Derek's eyes sparkle with amusement. "I suppose you could think of it that way." The robed woman returns with a catalog of dishes listed on a single sheet of paper, and I'm shocked to discover, as Derek points out, that most of the items have been grown hydroponically. "This must be terribly expensive," I say, mouth watering. "I can't afford this, I'm sure of it." "Relax," Derek says. "Everyone gets credit for a meal like this once a month. I've got a couple saved up, and you must have at least a dozen just sitting there, unused." I cover my surprise and confusion by studying the menu. I have the sense of riding an iceberg in a limitless ocean, borne up by a vast bulk, the composition of which I can't begin to fathom. Choosing more or less at random, I select an opener of fine pasta garnished with grated cheeses and truffle shavings, and a spiced squash tart as a main course. Derek places our orders, a process invisible to me, choosing a fruit assortment and a roulade of vegetables and nuts for himself. He folds his hands and leans forward. "So, what's on your mind, Jude?" "Oh, this and that," I say, and shrug. "I was thinking today about what it would be like to live out in space." Derek shakes his head, grinning. "We do live in space. Or hadn't you noticed?" "No, I mean in space, like the exomorphs, just floating there in the middle of nothing." "Well, it's not nothing. There is a structure, a lattice, to grow their colony in. But it's not much, and it's open to space. I didn't know there were such creatures, such people, until today. I read it on the fishbowl during work. Can you even imagine the mods you'd need for that?" "Serious work indeed," Derek says. "Not to be undertaken lightly." "No one on our crew has work that serious. They all look pretty much normal, at least when they're dressed. The more radical mods are often specialization for particular types of work. We're unskilled labor, our crew, Jude." I nod, having figured this out without really being able to articulate it. I take a deep breath. "Derek, can I ask you something personal?" He laces his fingers together and rests his joined hands on the table. The green of his palms has crept halfway up his arms in the time since I met him, and his ears are now tinged green as well, though I can't make the hues out well in this light. His gaze upon me is very open and direct and unsettling, more so because every day I come to know better how little I understand of his world, layered as it is above and beneath and around mine. "I don't know. Can you?" he says. "I don't know. I'll try." "I've learned some things about him from the fishbowl at work without really trying. For instance, the distressing fact that he has three biological mothers. But nothing that doesn't just whet my curiosity. I look down at the glowing table and take a deep breath. I'm just wondering if there's some, I don't know, some practical reason for your mods, something functional. You know, what the blue skin turning green is all about. There's a time for love and a time to hate, Derek says with a rakish smile. A time for blue and a time for green. I puff out an exasperated breath. Do you spend all your time looking up things in the manual you can make fun of? He shakes his head. You do understand, don't you, Jude? He says animatedly, that a book called the Bible existed long before Titus Grant slapped his own generic title on it, and that it's not exactly an obscure work in the human literary canon. High Foreman Titus didn't just change the title. Under the builder's inspiration, he clarified and corrected. Derek extends a finger until it almost touches my lips, waving his other hand preemptively. Yes, fine, but you understand he didn't write the manual from scratch. All right, fine, I understand, I say. So what about the color change? He leans back in his chair. Right, that. It's not really anything practical. There's nothing I can point to and say my skin color accomplishes. In fact, it's mostly a random aesthetic process. I'm never sure what color's coming up next. Then why did you do it? I mean, what's the purpose? It keeps me interested, Derek says, and his smile cracks momentarily. I see me and not me in the mirror at the same time, and there's always the mystery of what's coming next. It's as good a reason to stick around as any. He leans forward again, and to my ears, his heartiness now sounds forced. What makes you curious, friend? I shake my head. I don't know. Nothing. You're thinking about the job, aren't you? The vacuum job this 4-day. I look out the viewport at the stars, but the view seems to tilt and wheel beneath me, spinning my sense of balance away. Maybe, I admit. You know, Derek says with a trace of his vigorous smile, if you do it, a lot of folks on the crew are going to be disappointed. People are starting to get protective of you, and you may make them feel like they've corrupted you. It's not their decision, I say. Agreed. A different woman brings us our opening course, a thick tail moving in counterpoint to the balanced trays in her hands protrudes from beneath her black robe. Attention to the food spares Derek and me from the burden of conversation. I'm not sure I enjoy all the lush, strange flavors on my plate, but I know I've never tasted anything so vivid. I swallow every last crumb. Derek seems uncharacteristically fidgety between courses, but it's not until our main courses have arrived and I'm halfway through my tart, excellent, that he says, Jude, can I ask you something? Sure, I say between bites. He swallows. What is it that happened to your mother? The bite I've just taken feels too big going down my throat. How do you know about my mother? I'm sorry, I'm not trying to pry. He wipes his mouth with a cloth serviette that actually shows slight stains of use. It's hard sometimes to look at you and not make the easy jumps back through your genealogy. My mother died when I was small, 4 or 5, I say, setting down my fork and holding my gaze steady with great effort. I'm not clear exactly how. My father doesn't like to talk about it, and I don't like to press him. Derek opens his mouth, looking confused, and for a moment I have the strangest feeling he's going to tell me how it happened. I feel the sting beginning behind my eyes at the thought that he might know more about it than I do. But what he says is, do you think about her much? I nod. All the time. He looks so stricken at this that I feel I could be looking at a reflection of my own expression in a blue-tinted mirror. Or, so I believe for a giddy, wildly hopeful moment, at my mother. The illusion shatters as Derek rises suddenly in his chair, takes my face in both his green hands, and leans in to kiss me on the mouth. He stares at me a second or two, an eternity, and sits back down. Breathless, I turn to the window. Netherheim has swung into view, A giant ball of spun sugar swirled with red and yellow stripes. A fruit as sweet and bursting and sick-making as my heart inside me. I sit very still, not looking at him. My pulse is racing about 100 clicks a second. I don't know if I can finish this, I say, and push the rest of my tart away. Jude, I'm sorry, Derek says, his eyes very steady and direct. Why did you do that? I ask. Asking a question is better than yelling, or crying, or hitting the table. Derek spreads his green palms. They look black with blood in the cafeteria's hellish light. I forgot for a minute what a kiss signifies to your people. Let myself forget, to be honest. To us, the groups I identify with at least, it can be a greeting between friends, a show of camaraderie or comfort, even the equivalent of a slap. It doesn't have to have a sexual connotation. But why did you do it? Derek sighs. Jude, you just seemed so sad. I couldn't stand it. Lonely and sad. He shakes his head. You reminded me of me when I was your age. Sometimes I wish someone had just done that for me. Do I believe him? I'm not sure. I look out the viewport. Netherheim is just beginning to slide out of view. A cauldron of emotion, like the multicolored atmosphere of the planet below, seethes inside me. I want to storm out of the room. I want to turn a somersault in the air. I want to shake Derek by the shoulders until his head flops like a scrap doll's. I think about Nicodemus, wondering what I ever saw in him. I'm sorry, I say. Can you help me find an elevator to level 6? Of course, Jude. The compassion and concern in Derek's voice are unbearable. So is the heartbreak. Home, safe from the sea of wild bodies and leering faces that populate the station, I fall to my knees. I should pray to the Builder for forgiveness, for putting myself in such a compromised position, but instead I thumb the combination on the wooden chest in the middle of the deck. Thomas is still out, and with leave for at least another hour. He doesn't know that I long ago surfed the combination over his shoulder. The lid swings back on stiff, creaky, decidedly low-tech hinges, revealing the layered treasures within. Reverently, I lift out the first folded garment, hearing in my mind a surreal ghost of Kaya's voice telling Thomas to keep this. She'll have no use for it where she's going. I unfold and smooth out the soft gray dress with the inclined plane on the bosom. Then, hands trembling, pull it over my head and slip my arms through the sleeves, as I've done maybe half a dozen times before in my life. The fabric is tight across my shoulders and under my arms, much tighter than it was the time before. There's no hope of closing the buttons at the back. This may be the last time I can manage to fit into it at all. Sobs rise up inside me as I yearn for angel wings to bear me away. To be concluded. Inclination, Part 2. Copyright 2006 by William Shun. All rights reserved. This sound recording, copyright 2007 by William Shun, is made available under a Creative Commons 3.0 United States license, which permits redistribution only with proper attribution, unaltered, for non-commercial purposes. For more information, and for the other two parts in the series, please see www.shun.net/inclination. For more readings by William Shun, including the full text of the Mormon missionary memoir, The Accidental Terrorist, please visit shun.net/podcast and explore past episodes of William Shun's Shuncast. This recording has been a production of Sinister Regard.